Ladies and Gentlemen, meine Damen und Herren, wir können anfangen. Und ich habe das große Vergnügen, Ihnen Julian Özrau vorzustellen, der in einem gewissen Sinn auch ein Beispiel für eine internationale Biografie ist. Kommt aus Frankreich, hat ja sein Baccalaureat dort gemacht, hat sich dann nach Australien bewegt, in Sydney sein Pre-Graduate Studies gemacht, und I got to know him when I visited Macquarie, and I know Macquarie University is one of the few places in the world where there's a exemplary sound relationship between early Christian and ancient studies. And he is one of the gifts that I could bring back from Macquarie after Ulrich Huttner became professor in Siegen, which was a very good thing for us, but it left us with a problem. And Julian could fill this position, which is a very good thing, having a Frenchman working in Macedonia. And that is exactly what he will be talking about now.
Well done. I may be a perfect fit for Macedonia. I'm not sure I'm a perfect fit for Ulrich Huttner's very, very large shoes. So I've done my best to fill them as best I could. But up until the 10th century or so, when visitors traveling along the Via Egnatia entered Thessalonica through the eastern gate of Kalamaria, they would have been greeted by the statue of the Hipparchos Basileios, prominently perched above the gate itself, or perhaps nestled in an alcove. The figure was accompanied by an epigram exalting the Praetorian prefect, certainly one of the highest imperial officials, and commanding passers-by the utmost respect and gratitude for Basileios' rule. Number one on your handout. Exult in your heart, O stranger, who sees above the gate the prefect Basileios, the destroyer of the mightily arrogant Babylon, a beacon of incorruptible justice. You travel towards the land of good governments, Evnomia, that produces the best. Neither fear the barbarian, nor men who lie together. The Lacedaemonian has weapons, but you have a statue of Basileios as a rampart. The date of this inscription, which is only attested by a copy in the collection of Greek epigrams known as the Antologia Palatina, has somewhat been a point of contentions amongst epigraphists and Byzantinists, who have placed it either in the 10th century, in the 9th century, between the 7th and 8th centuries, or between the 4th and 6th centuries. At issue, of course, is the identity of the Hipparchos Basileios, whom older editors have recognized as the Emperor Basil I, while others have taken him to be the Parakoimomenos Basil, who defeated the Arabs at Samosata in 958, or simply the governor of a maritime city, i.e. Thessalonica. Cyril Mengo, on the other hand, has argued that Basileios should be identified with a certain Basilides, one of Justinian's most trusted ministers, who happened to be the Praetorian prefect of Illyricum in 529, a year only after Justinian outlawed pederasty at the very beginning of his reign in 528. This remarkable coincidence, as Mengo put it, may account for the second part of line 4, though it does not really explain the allusions to the military victory in line 1, a defeat which Mengo himself acknowledges no prefect could have inflicted on the Persians between the reign of Constantine and the end of the 6th century, since the Praefectus Praetorio no longer had military power. Also debatable are the Christian identity of Basileios and the Christian character of his inscriptions, which, for reasons that are not entirely clear to me, was included in Denis Fessel's recueil of Christian inscriptions from Macedonia. No particular symbol, no explicit vocabulary makes it stand out as specifically Christian, except perhaps the reference to the Arsenis Arsenokite, men who sleep together, in line 4. This may be because the original editor who compiled the Antologia omitted the cross or crosses that may have preceded and or closed the epigram, and which are sometimes observed in Sibyl inscriptions from late antiquity. Yet one cannot be sure. Whether or not Mengo's dating and identification of Basileios are correct, what is clear enough is that this epigram belongs to a corpus of late antique imperial inscriptions that were composed in a then resolutely Christian Roman Empire. As such, it illustrates how the power and authority of high officials were conceived and represented in public spaces in Justinianic times, and could somewhat be thought to symbolize the culmination of a long process of transformation of the structures and discourses of power in the Roman Empire. Remarkably, Basileus is here depicted as a slayer of the Persian, as a beacon of incorruptible justice, and as a defender of a city who ensures its safety, good governance, and moral uprightness, attributes which, one would think, might have been exclusively applied to the risen Christ in a Christian empire, or at least to a patron saint such as Saint Demetrius, the patron saint of Thessalonica, who is also compared to an unshakable and unconquerable wall in the 6th century account of his miracles. Yet, as Louis Robert pointed out, the praises herein lavished upon Basileus, as well as the themes of Dikes and Evnomia, are not specifically Christian, but belong to a rich repertoire of laudatory epigrams usually composed for governors and prefects, be they Christian or not, between the end of the 3rd and the 6th centuries. These echoes of familiar encomiastic themes suggest a certain conceptual, if not terminological, continuity and coherence in imperial ideology and discourses of power throughout the Roman era. In a similar vein, it may be remarked that the prominent display of Basileus' statue above the city gate seems to follow a well-attested regional practice of erecting images of deities in a prophylactic or apotropaic manner in niches of city gates, a custom which may actually have been imported from the East, where, in the Syrian city of Anastata, for instance, statues of Christ, the emperors, the praetorian prefects, as well as the local bishops, were set up at the main city gates to protect it against Persian invaders. This suggests a certain Christian accommodation to and adaptation of Greco-Roman cultural and religious practices, and raises questions about the nature, significance, and extent of the Christianization of the Roman Empire. It also challenges somewhat the idea of a dramatic Christian subversion of Roman socio-political institutions, and that of a distinctiveness of Christian culture and identity in late Roman Macedonia. In sum, Basileus' triumphant epigram is as ambivalent a piece of evidence as can be. It is a vivid illustration of how difficult the issue of dating remains, and how intricate the question of defining Christian identity and authority, or even Christian epigraphy, is, especially once Christianity has become more institutionalized in later antiquity. It is a sobering reminder to beware of unnuance and categorical conclusions that might downplay or overlook what could easily be blurred social, cultural, and religious distinctions. Excuse me. What can be asserted with relative confidence from a broad survey of the 300 or so early Christian Macedonian inscriptions, however, is that in Macedonia as elsewhere, a distinctive Christian identity emerged from a deeply pagan Greco-Roman cultural milieu only progressively. The first Macedonian Christians do not seem to have left a mark on the local material culture and to have claimed a place in the civic life of their communities in any significant manner before the 4th century. This is at least what is apparent from the surviving body of evidence, which, it must be kept in mind, is to an extent that is difficult to measure, only partially representative of the ancient reality. Unlike in Phrygia or Lycaonia, there is simply no inscriptions that can securely dated to the 2nd century, and only a handful from the 3rd century, which leaves a sizable gap in our sources and makes it very difficult to discern patterns of identity formation and authority legitimization during the first 3 to 4th centuries. Be that as it may, what is quite clear is that Basileus' extravagant claims are, to my knowledge, unmatched in the whole corpus of Paleo-Christian and Proto-Byzantine inscriptions from Macedonia. This might be because he is one of the very few attested, supposedly Christian hipparchi in the province, and one of the few known members of a local elites. Not unlike in other regions of Asia Minor, the earliest Christian Macedonian inscriptions are hardly distinguishable from pagan inscriptions. They mainly consist of very late 2nd or 3rd century epitaphs originating principally from Edessa, Veroia, and Thessalonica, which closely resembles standard non-Christian epitaphs in formulary and style, employing typical formulas such as Odena, Todeni, Nemis, Karin, If I return back to the map, it's all on this eastern side of Macedonia, or central Macedonia, that these early inscriptions are found. Christian identity is, generally speaking, simply and subtly expressed, and in the absence of Christian symbols, is often only recognizable from singular phrases and expressions such as the acclamations, "Thesis in Theo," "May you live in God," which appears on a series of epitaphs from Edessa. Other hints include the imprecation, "Thosi kurior logon," as well as rare references to the day of the resurrection, to eternal life, to divine washing, i.e. baptism, or even to the Trinity. The epitaph of the little Xanthia is a classic example. On your outline number 2. It could easily be confused with the non-Christian inscriptions, "Wait not for the fish and what seems to be two birds engraved underneath this," as you can see on the board. Similarly, the Steli Marciani set up for a grandmother, so on item number 3, which features a veiled woman pointing to or touching a small altar, is difficult to classify with certainty as Christian, despite the allusion to a fulfilling the funeral commemoration for God, "Pros Theon ergatsomene," a phrase which, interestingly enough, finds some echoes in the New Testament, but which should not be seen as a decisive clue of Christian identity. There's a booty trap with this. We need to come back to this, but I had to skip things, so please ask questions. The same could be said of the second or third century epitaphs of the Presbyteros Apollonius, item number 4, which was copied by Leon Oze at a house at Thessalonica. Do I have it? Neither the title Presbyteros nor the palm branch next to it allows to determine with certainty whether Apollonius was Jewish or Christian. Similarities between Christian and non-Christian inscriptions suggest that at Philippi, for instance, some of these epitaphs could have been executed by the same hand, in the same workshop, and about the same period. This in turn implies that, early on, Christians had no objection, or perhaps no other options, but to hire the same lapidarius as their pagan neighbours. They, or the stonecutter, could employ roughly the same epigraphic formulary, though with some adaptations, probably at the request of his clients. Even in the late 4th or early 5th centuries, Christians could still have their epitaphs engraved on Hellenistic-styled steles, as the Philippian tombstones of Diconis Posidonia and the Canonici Pancaria illustrates. Actually, there are a lot more examples of these. Whether the two women wished to make a point about their Greek heritage and identity, or whether the engraver used whatever stone was available, is not clear. What is evident, however, is that Christianity neither eradicated nor replaced Greco-Roman culture altogether, but, to an extent that remains difficult to evaluate, somewhat accommodated itself to it. In fact, a few early inscriptions present both pagan and Christian traits, which further suggests that, in its earlier stages, Christian material culture may not have been as distinct from Greco-Roman material culture as in subsequent centuries. For example, in the 3rd century epigram of Epaphroditus found at Edessa, number 5, new handout. So this epigram, whose styles and motifs are borrowed from Hellenistic funerary eulogy, and whose Christian character can only be deduced from the use of the term pistos and the bottom scenery, the deceased is said to have fulfilled his astrological destiny, genesin ivi anapiplemse, an astrological fatalistic concept which would later be condemned by the church as superstitious. And I don't know if you can discern these elements, decorative elements here. Very faded. Similarly, on a fourth century marble kippis from Veroia, number 6, whose purpose and function remains unclear, was engraved with an adjuration both to the Holy and Almighty God and to the Tichi or the emperors, a combination which is rather unusual in inscriptions, though well attested in papyri from the 4th to the 7th century. Christian symbols, one of the hallmarks of Christian identity, took time to impose themselves as essential apparatuses. Christograms, for example, are scarce in the earliest inscriptions from Edessa and Veroia, and only appear on the epitaphs of Stercorios and on that of Nicasios, on which it is flanked by an Alpha and Omega, as well as two peacocks. So it's Stercorios. You can see sort of faded out the crystallogram and Nicasios. All of these, of course, are available, taken from the database, which I hope you can begin to see the usefulness of. The symbol also occurs on the side of what could be a pre-Constantinian sarcophagus from Thessalonica, on which Thessalas suggests it stands for the adjective Christianos, an epithet which can sometimes be spelt out as in the slightly later epitaphs of a newly baptized Eutychios, so number 7 and number 8 on your outline. And number 7 appear above, which you can see at the Byzantine Museum in Thessalonica. You can very well see that. We need to discuss that one too, because it's not clear in the syntax what that symbol is doing, whether it's for the adjective or not. From the 4th century onwards, Christograms become, of course, more common and much less discreet, as the epitaph of Coprilos illustrates, so very boldly at the top. Meanwhile, Latin or Greek crosses are employed more systematically and sometimes more profusely, as the epitaph of Dionysus, which totalizes no fewer than 5 Greek crosses and 2 Christograms, exemplifies. So I don't know if you can see them. Maybe I should. Oop. Okay, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. I suppose he's like, I'm Christian, you get it? Must be the message. Nomina sacra are equally rare at first and can be observed only on a handful of inscriptions, namely on the epitaph of Nicasio seen earlier, on the sarcophagus of Helios Lycos, in which a cross has been inserted between the chi and the rho, which is rather unusual before the 6th centuries, and on the epitaph of Philokyrios found at Parthenion, the only such early example of the acrostics Ixthus. It appears once more in a later edition epitaphs along the acrostic Chi Mu Gamma. Very top. Chi Mu Gamma, which is also found on 3 other inscriptions from Veroia and Thessalonica, as well as on numerous papyri, inscriptions, and amphorae throughout the Greek East from the 4th to the 7th century. Its significance remains debated and has been variously interpreted as the 3 names Christos, Michael, Gabriel, or as the phrase Christos, Maria, Yenea, Mary begot Christ, or as the phrase Christos ec Maria Yenesis, Christ born of Mary, or even as an apotropaic isopsesism, meaning Theos Boethios, i.e. God the Helper. More specific vocabulary, such as kimiterion, a term which is frequently used at Athens, Corinth, and in Asia Minor to designate the tomb as a place of rest whilst awaiting the resurrection, becomes more usual throughout Central and Eastern Macedonia from the 4th century onwards. However, it is rarely encountered at Edessa, where the term memorion, an obvious translation of the Latin word memoria, predominates. Terms such as these are particularly helpful to identify with greater certainty Christian epitaphs, as are biblical and liturgical citations or allusions, as well as the epithets such as Elachistos, Evlavistatos, Philophistatos, or Thulos, Thuli, to Theu, to Christu. These epithets seem to come in fashion, so to speak, in the late 4th and 5th centuries, especially amongst members of the clergy, who must have thereby sought to emphasize their humility or piety, and also perhaps to legitimize, posthumously, their respectability as leaders of a Christian community. Whilst they may have done so at times under the cover of pretense, such self-representation does nonetheless contrast with the narcissistic and hubristic discourse prevalent in non-Christian Greek and Latin inscriptions from the period, in which one's social status, cursus honorum, and civil or military achievements are conceived as core elements defining one's identity and establishing or reinforcing one's power and authority over the community. Overall, apart from a few exceptions, such as Basileios' epigram, Christian Macedonian inscriptions remain largely unassuming, unpretentious, and unassertive from a social or political point of view at least, even after the so-called Peace of the Church from 313 onwards. They are mostly modest in style and of moderate style compared to non-Christian epitaphs, which tend to be more pompous in recalling the merits of a deceased, and which were often displayed on sizable steles, sarcophagi, or cenotaphs in visible public locations. And you go to Philippi, and right outside there, have this massive 3-meter-high tomb monument. This might simply be because a majority of the first Macedonian Christians came from the lower echelons of society. Yet, even inscriptions of Christian local elites usually retain a more humble outlook and fail to include the full cursus honorum, civic offices or honorary titles being mentioned only succinctly, as a Philippian epitaph of the Via Clarissimus Mauritius illustrates, which is item number 10. And I have it also here on the screen. Thanks to Pilofer Sr. This is perhaps somewhat less true of the item number 11, the epitaph of a tribune of a notaries Andreas, which is slightly more pompous, and also from Philippi. In effect, these inscriptions reflect a subtle but fundamental paradigm shift of a traditional means of self-representation, and perhaps a critique of a Greco-Roman value system of honor and self-advertisement, which, it seems, the early Christians gradually replaced with a new canon of moral virtues and aesthetics modeled on the humble demeanor of Christ. The Macedonian Christians really burst out on the epigraphic scene with the advent of Constantine, after which, for obvious reasons, they appear more confident and keen to identify themselves and be remembered as such. Unsurprisingly, the bulk of the extant epigraphic evidence, there are about 85% of inscriptions in total, can be dated between the 4th and 6th centuries, period during which, incidentally, the Roman epigraphic habit is generally thought to have steadily declined. They comprise primarily epitaphs of local clergy or of private individuals, many of whom, in keeping with the Roman epigraphic habit this time, make a point of mentioning their vocation, military ranks, or office in the imperial administration. The corpus also includes a good number of ex voto and building a mosaic dedications, such as the early 4th century mosaic inscription by the Bishop Porphyrius, which identifies the Basilica of Paul at Philippi, one of, if not the earliest known church in the whole Balkan region, which you may have seen if you visit the site, and it's effectively located there on the bottom left-hand corner. Also noteworthy is the late 5th century wall mosaic of the church of Hostios David, or Moni Latomu. I'll go straight down because it's the biggest and most impressive picture. You're not supposed to take that picture. I took it off Wikipedia, so I didn't break the law. 5th century wall mosaic of the church of Hostios David, which is located on the southern slopes of the Anopolis at Thessalonica, which, as Laura Nasralla has shown, is of critical importance for our understanding of interpretation and authorization of early Christian texts such as Revelation in early Macedonian Christianity. Unlike such refined mosaics, the decorative elements of most epitaphs between the 4th and 6th centuries remain rather poor and minimalist, however. Likewise, the formulary is usually basic, and the engraving and material used often coarse. This may have little to do with a humble conception of Christian identity and self-esteem, however, and more to do with the socio-economic background of the Macedonian Christians, most of whom appear to have come from modest origins. Very few Christian sarcophagi have, for instance, been discovered, perhaps 2-3, and Christian local elites remain overall relatively discreet in the epigraphic record, especially before the 4th century. As might have been expected, it is at Thessalonica, by far the most important urban centre of Macedonia in the Roman imperial and early Byzantine eras, the city which Constantine considered for a time as a potential new Rome of the East, that some of the most elaborately decorated funerary monuments have been found in the city's necropolises, along with, it must be said, a large number of plain tombstones. These consist of 2 to 3 meter long vaulted tombs dating from the 4th century or later that were lavishly decorated in bright, expensive colors with biblical and paradisiac scenes, as well as with bold Christograms and Latin crosses. One stunning example. I don't know what is the best angle, perhaps this one is, for the back wall. Can you see this clearly? Thank you very much. Is this clearer? You must go on the database online later on, I'm afraid. One stunning example is the early 4th century tomb of Estorgia and her husband, who are here depicted on the back wall alongside two children or servants, while peacocks adorn the side walls. The greeting, Ujenite, Parodite, farewell, passerby, in the enriched inscription is somewhat ironic, as the tomb would have been locked and the greeting, as well as the murals, hidden from sight. It is thus perhaps preferable not to speak of a public representation of Christian identity in this context. The Christian symbols and the biblical scenes may well have been large and conspicuous, precisely because they were out of sight. Decorated vaulted tombs similar to these have also been found in the very partially excavated eastern necropolis of Philippi. One of them features a large Latin cross with slightly footed branches, which is contained within a circular garland and is flanked by what resembles two peacocks. Sorry, no collar this time. The medallion itself is bordered by a semicircular band on which a prayer for the resurrection of the tomb's occupants has been painted in white letters on a dark background, number 12. Beside the elaborate ornamentation which so far remains unmatched at Philippi, it is the deceased's plea to be resurrected, anastison himas, and they claim to have died in the upright faith, anti orthi pisti, that is particularly remarkable. Although not infrequent in literary sources from the 2nd century onwards, references to upright faith, orthi pistis, are extremely rare in inscriptions and, to my knowledge, without equivalent in the whole of Macedonia. More common is the claim to orthodox pistis, which has been observed at Constantinople, Thebes, Ephesus and Iconium, where a deacon prided himself to have led his life ex pisteos orthodoxu. Along with the decorative style, this suggests a date for the Philippian tomb in the pre- or post-Nicene period, a crucial time for the formation of Christian identity and for the formation of Christian identity and orthodoxa, orthodox doctrine. The expression orthi pistis thus likely ought to be heard against the backdrop of the theological disputes that rocked the church in the late 3rd and early 4th centuries. Not surprisingly, it is from this period that we begin to notice confessional claims in inscriptions, which denotes an important shift in Christian self-identification and self-representation. The concern seems no longer simply to distinguish oneself from non-Christians, as in the early beginnings, but now also from deviant non-Orthodox Christians. This is especially true of clergy members such as the Philippian Presbyteros Faustinos Dostanos and Aurelius Capiton, number 13, who took great care to mention on their tombstones that they were legitimate ministers of a Catholic and Apostolic Holy Church, Catholici che Apostolici Iglesia, which, in the final words of a Nicene Creed, anathematize those who reject the authorized statement of faith. Incidentally, these epitaphs confirm that, even in a peripheral city such as Philippi, was not left unaffected by the controversy, which helps explain why it had to send one of its bishops, the Bishop Porphyrius mentioned earlier, to attend the Synod of Serdica in 342, 343 or 44. But the desire to stress one's adherence to the Nicene faith ought perhaps to be understood in the light of a broader epigraphic corpus from the 4th and 5th centuries, which reveals an increasing concern to affirm, sometimes in a particular verbose fashion, one's piety, sanctity, and even charity towards the poor, the widows, and the orphans. This is once more primarily true of clerics, or lay people deeply devoted in the life of the ecclesial communities, such as the Virgin, Eternal Virgin Theodora, the abbess of a convent near Beroia, who was commemorated in an epigram as a divine gift, a teacher of chastity, a holy root from which sprang forth noble shoots, and a spiritual guide of reverend virgins. Here on the board. But the late 5th century, it is as though a real anguish over sin has taken hold of conscience-stricken clergy, who often include pleas for mercy and forgiveness dressed in liturgical language, or simply confess themselves as sinners. The epitaph of the Presbyteros Kyprianos, number 14, who appeals to the divine Pantokrator and to the intercessory prayers of all the angels, prophets, apostles, and martyrs, is a particularly vivid example. However, others, number 15, such as the enigmatic Andreas, who is buried in the nave of a small church located 300 meters south of the Basilica Extramuros at Philippi, appears to have been less encumbered with such consideration, and simply prided himself to have fulfilled everything worthily of a mystagogical authority, piously delighting in the divine ordinances. With these last few inscriptions, one rather gains the sense that the emphasis on piety and on doctrinal and ethical purity is meant to authenticate and stress one's Orthodox Christian identity. The more pious, the more virtuous, the more authentically Christian. One also gets the idea that it was meant to highlight and therefore to reinforce somehow one's legitimacy as a leader of a Christian community, which seems rather vain for someone who's just passed away and is thus no longer in charge. In this respect, these Macedonian Christians differ little from their pagan contemporaries, who, since classical times, were concerned to control how they would continue to live on in the community's collective memory, having transcended earthly mortality through epigraphic commemoration. Coming to my conclusion. Overall, the few inscriptions here in exam illustrate that, in Macedonia as elsewhere, the first Christian emerged from a deeply pagan Greco-Roman cultural environment and developed their own identity and material culture only progressively. Unfortunately, the earlier stages of development remain rather obscure, as hardly no evidence earlier than the 3rd century has survived. This may be because, as Christian Thomas has suggested, the early Christian had almost no distinct material culture, and that it was generally not used in a uniform fashion to mark their religious identity. Or it may simply be that the little evidence that once attested the existence of 1st or 2nd century Christians has not survived. One will note also the almost complete absence of any Jewish influence in the material culture and onomastic, which seems to confirm the predominantly Greco-Roman ethnic background of the early Macedonian Christians, and which suggests that Christian mission had little impact, perhaps, on local Jewish communities. At the same time, the blended character of Macedonian Christian epigraphy and identity somewhat confirm Ramzi MacMullan's general observation in the closing study of Christianity and paganism, that is, the advent of Christianity did not and could not conclude in any sort of a total eclipse of displacement of the past. The triumph of the church was indeed one not of obliteration, but of widening embrace and assimilation of Greco-Roman cultural and religious beliefs and practices. Vasileios' epigram examining the introduction would seem to support this point, although it suggests perhaps more reciprocal and dynamic cultural interaction, cross-fertilization, and assimilation between Christians and non-Christians than MacMullan may have envisaged. One could in fact argue that, ultimately, the empire's widening embrace and assimilation of Christianity made the so-called triumph of the church as much possible as the church's assimilation of paganism. This said, the emergence of a singular Christian identity, material culture, and intellectual thought in the late antiquity should not be trivialized as easily as MacMullan sometimes does. We should also be careful not to overlook too readily what Edwin Judge has described as the sustained and calculated subversion of a classical understanding of the world, which the Christian intellectual enterprise operated as it rejected fundamental principles of philosophy, psychology, education, and politics, and created alternative community structures. Subtle hints of his profound social-cultural revolution are certainly visible in the epigraphic record of Macedonia, which reveals a gradual yet fundamental transformation of a conception and public representation of the self and of a construction and exercise of authority. Thank you very much.